It was my intention this morning after teaching Revelation 6 Wednesday night to kind of saunter in this morning, find Jeff and approach him and give him a very large hug. We're going to have to postpone that till Wednesday night, Lord willing. Still going to do it, but maybe with a different emphasis. We are, this morning, chapter 7 of Revelation as we continue our study. Revelation chapter 7. We have what is the first of the couple of interludes which appear in the book. We're right in the middle of something, and then all of a sudden there's a big pause and a big stepping back and then ultimately starting from there and moving forward again. And this is the first one that appears. In the context from Wednesday night's class, chapter 6 is the opening of the seals. And there are seven seals. And at the end of chapter 6, seven seals. And at the end of chapter 6, we've opened six of the seven seals. And this is where the interlude appears. There are six seals have been opened, one interlude, an interlude then with one large seal that remains to be opened. And we get to discuss that. I do want you to note the last verse of chapter 6. Chapter 6 ends with one of Revelation's great scenes of judgment. Some discussion about what judgment scene is appearing there, but we'll leave that up for now. For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? That is the last verse which concludes the sixth chapter. And as we move from chapter 6 into chapter 7, I'll make the suggestion to you that what we're seeing in chapter 7 is the answer to this question. This question is not being asked by angels or godly people. This question is actually being asked by those who are being judged, those who are trying to hide underneath the mountains because the wrath of God is coming upon them. They want to know who is able to stand in the day of the Lord's wrath. Well, who is able to stand? The ones who are sealed. And that's where we lead in from chapter 6 into the 7th chapter of Revelation. Couple of things just to say in general. There is an effect here that is being created in the book of Revelation. This is the first of the interludes. It's not the only one. We have seven seals. We have seven trumpets followed by seven bowls of wrath. The trumpets also have a fairly lengthy interlude where we're in the middle of the blowing of the trumpets. We get the first six done, and then there's this great pause that takes place before the last trumpet is actually sounded. Imagine the effect of this on audiobook. Maybe that's the best way to talk about it. If you're listening to the book of Revelation on audio, and those are common now, you get the effect, I think, much more the way that it would have been understood and appreciated by the original audience. We're going through these great scenes of judgment, and then all of a sudden there is this great stepping back from that judgment, this great pause, and a discussion which, quite frankly, is one of great hope for the children of God, just the opposite. There is an effect that is created in that. It's like going to a concert and you hear two or three really fast-paced songs at once, and then the band stops and they play as a really slow ballad. What's the effect on you? It has something that when you hear it, I think you can understand the sense of what's going on here. And to talk in generality and then to come back into the specifics of it, what we're looking at is, I think in some ways, being placed here right after the first great judgment scene, you have this first great scene of assurance for the children of God. Is God going to protect us from all of the uncertainties of life? Are we going to be protected from tribulation and persecution and hunger and thirst and suffering in life? Is that what God's going to do? Well, Brother Bingham shaking his head. No, I don't think that's what this is for. This is, again, in my mind, mirroring back to Romans chapter 8. Who can separate us from the love of God? You know, we're going to face all of those difficulties, but we have the assurance that in spite of that, those who have been sealed by God, He's still with them. And there's going to be this great reward that's going to come from faithfulness. Could also make the case that there is in this an explanation of delay. We have this great scene in chapter 6. We have the four horsemen of the apocalypse who are sent forth to judge the world. They're sent forth And then when we get to this point, what actually happens? The answer is nothing. Because when you get to the start of chapter 7, there is this great holding back of that judgment. Nothing's happening yet. Chapter 6, the seals, the scroll, is again the revelation of God's plan, not the actual carrying out of that plan necessarily. Trumpets, warning, judgment, bowls of wrath, the real wrath of God being poured out. But we just are now getting, first of all, an explanation of that, but then an assurance that in spite of these things to come, God is going to bring blessing. But the fifth seal, if you step back to that point, was the cry of the martyrs, those who are underneath the throne, those who are crying out, how long? Waiting for God to come and to bring his judgment upon the wicked. This is, again, perhaps more explanation of delay, that before these things can happen, there needs to be something else to take place first. So we come to chapter 7 and the first several verses here. After these things, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth or on the sea or on any tree. Then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees till we have sealed the servants of our God on their forehead." And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 of the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. I'm going to actually go through and read this. And I want you to notice, because this becomes interesting in the discussion, the tribes. Can you name the 12 tribes of Israel? I'm pausing here before I get ahead of myself. 12 tribes of Israel. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. We got Dan, we got Gad, we got Asher, we got Naphtali. Who are we leaving out? We've got Levi, we've got Joseph and Benjamin, and I've missed one. Zebulun. Okay, we got all 12. Except, if you look at a map of the conquest of Canaan and the division of the land, you don't see a tribe of Levi, and you don't see a tribe of Joseph. What do you see instead? Ephraim and Manasseh. Again, Joseph. He was the favored son of his father, and I think we could argue that he received a double portion of the inheritance. He received the birthright that was passed on from father to son, and so when they enter the land of Canaan, Joseph receives a double portion of the inheritance of the land, two tribes representing him instead of one singular tribe. What happened to Levi? The Levites were scattered throughout all of the land to be priests, to minister, and to teach the children of Israel. And so they were not given a single land inheritance. They were given various cities. So when you go through and you study the Old Testament and you read about the 12 tribes of Israel, you may see an interesting different variety of things. What are we talking about? Are we talking about the actual sons of Jacob? Are we talking about the land inheritances which they received? Depending upon what the perspective is, you will see a different list. And I don't have the totality of the list, but at least one writer I read said that there are at least 19 different ways in the Old Testament that you see the 12 sons of Jacob listed. They are listed in all sorts of different varieties and fashions depending upon what the emphasis is. What becomes interesting is that none of those are the way that it's rendered here in Revelation chapter 7. This is the only place in the Bible you see this list of the 12 sons of Jacob. Of the tribes of Israel. It is unique in all of Scripture. And there's probably a point to that. So the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Reuben, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Gad, 12,000 were sealed. The tribe of Asher, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Simeon, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Levi, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Issachar, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Joseph, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000 were sealed. Who's missing? Dan and Ephraim are missing from this list. The Lord has included both Manasseh and Joseph, which is an interesting thing. But he has left out Ephraim and he has left out Dan, and we'll come back and talk about what maybe some of the sense of that is in just a moment. But I do want to go forward to see the second half of the picture. After these things, I looked and behold a great multitude, which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." And all the angels stood around the throne and the elders and the four living creatures and fell on their faces before the throne and worshipped God, saying, "Amen. Blessed, blessing and glory and wisdom, thanksgiving and honor, power and might be to the God, our God forever and ever. Amen." Then one of the elders answered and said to me, "Who are these arrayed in white robes and where did they come from?" I love John's answer. There's a couple of times where he's asked questions I think he doesn't necessarily know the answer to. And his answer is, "Sir, you know. Why don't you just tell me?" And so the answer is given. "These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation, washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them. They shall neither hunger any more nor thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them nor heat. For the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of water. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." So we get this great scene. We've just had the great judgment scene, and now we have this scene, which is one, obviously, that has some significance for us. It begins with four angels who are holding back the four winds. What does this appear to represent to us? We have nature in picture, four corners of the earth, and four winds that are coming from the four corners of the earth. I would suggest to you that this is a scene of judgment. These angels are here to render God's wrath upon the earth for the wickedness of mankind. And I think we get that based on verse 3. Another angel interrupts them and says, "Don't do it. There's something else that needs to happen first. What needs to happen before we're going to have the pouring out of God's wrath?" We have to have the sealing of the saints. And we're going to have the 144,000 sealed on their foreheads with the name of God. And again, this angel that descends from heaven. Who was this angel? Some suggest it could have been Michael or an archangel, but we're not given any information other than this angel comes bearing the seal of God. And in this seal of God, we get this image of it being used to seal these 144,000 with the Lord's name before we move forward with the scenes of judgment then that are going to follow. I think what is important to notice here is the contrast that begins here and then gets picked up in the 13th chapter. We don't usually think of the word seal. In fact, I think I heard the word mark. In many ways, seal is the correct term to use here because of what it conveys. If you bear someone's seal, the seal of obviously someone who is in great power and authority, then that seal means something for you. You have, I think, the sense of some level of protection with this, which is really what's being conveyed in the context here. Ownership, authority, protection, these are all granted by the seal of the name of God on your forehead. What's the big contrast with what comes later? Chapter 13. Yeah, we're not going to study this, but let's just look at this just for a second. Chapter 13 and in verse 16 talks about the beast that comes from the land. And as this beast comes forth, verse 16, it causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their forehead, that no one may buy or sell except who has the mark in the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let us calculate. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. You have a great contrast here, do you not? You have those who are the saints who are sealed with the name of God. You have those who are not saints who are bearing a mark instead. They're bearing the mark of the beast. We'll see what Jeff says when we get there. I tend to think that this is the great contrast of the book. Everybody's wearing one or the other. This is the nature of the decision of life, whether or not we are going to respond with obedience to God, obedience to the gospel. If we respond to Him the right way, then we bear the seal of His name on our foreheads. If we don't, we bear on our hand or on our forehead the mark of the beast. What's the difference between the seal and the mark? A seal conveys the idea of authority. It conveys the idea of protection. What does a mark get you? Nothing. And in the end, that's what you're going to get, if that's the two of the signs that you've chosen. But I'm going to make that suggestion to you that everybody's got one or the other. We're all wearing one or the other, and it simply depends upon the choices that we have made and do make that determine which is the one that we bear. To deal with this then, from the perspective, we have the 144,000 and we have the great multitude. And I already talked about this in terms of what I believe is going on here. There are those who believe that these are two different groups of people, and I want to fully acknowledge that. Among our own brethren, there are those who believe that this is perhaps a remnant of the Jews in symbolic language, symbolic terminology. The saved of the Old Testament, the saved of the Old Covenant under Judaism, who are then contrasted with the Gentile saved, if we could say it that way. But you're dealing with two different groups of saved people under two different covenants. And that would be a supporting text for the argument. We're dealing with the Old Testament saved. We're dealing with the New Testament saved in two different pictures. We have a little bit of a broader generalization. Homer Haley takes this position in his commentary that we're dealing with in chapter 7, the redeemed on earth. And we're dealing in with 144,000, and the great multitude is the redeemed in heaven. And we are looking at, again, the people who are the redeemed on earth are those who are going through this tribulation that runs along with the book of Revelation. And the great multitude in heaven are those who are already saved, those who are already redeemed. And that's the case that's made. I tend to be a generalist in the broadest sense and think that this is simply the same group of people that are talked about from a couple of perspectives. And I'll try to defend that view just a little bit as we go through. So let me say this. Again, the list of the tribes is unique. We have no Ephraim, we have no Dan, and we have an arrangement of the 12 tribes of Israel that does not correspond to any arrangement of the 12 tribes that ever appears in the Old Testament. And that is taken perhaps to be interesting. Jeff sent notes on this particular point. No Ephraim and no Manasseh. Robert Harkrider, in his commentary, says that the probable reason for this is the associations that come to sort of stick with these two tribes. Ephraim, throughout the minor prophets, is associated with Israel's idolatry. And because of the idolatry in that association, Ephraim, he suggests, got cut off the list. Dan, what did Dan do? Anybody remember the book of Judges? What happens to the whole tribe of Dan? They set up idols, and they have a strong idolatrous connection there. They're also the tribe, if you recall, that actually had to leave their inheritance. They abandoned the original inheritance that they were given in Canaan and headed out and settled elsewhere where they weren't as opposed by enemies. They were in obviously a difficult and somewhat dangerous place up on the northern border of Israel. Was that the right thing to do? For them to leave their inheritance that had been given under Joshua and to just find somewhere else to go settle? What would have been the right thing to do? Yeah. Turn to God. Trust in Him completely. serve him completely and faithfully, and then what would have happened to their enemies? God would have taken care of them. I think an argument is perhaps what the right answer might be for what's going on here. Two tribes that in one way or another, because of idolatry or because of simple abandon of their responsibilities, are displaced. But the other part of this that's really curious, if you actually look at the list in verses 5 through 8, we have Judah first. Would it make sense for Judah to be first? Why Judah first? Yeah, this is the tribe of the kings. This is the tribe, ultimately, of the Christ. And so it makes perfect sense to render this one as the first of the tribes on our list, because this is the tribe of the Messiah. Reuben, again, is displaced and comes down. Let me say this. I said when Jacob blessed his sons, he gave Joseph the birthright. He gave him the double portion of the inheritance. So his descendants end up with two tribes in Israel instead of simply one. Judah, he gave the blessing. Remember when Jacob and Esau, their story, you have the birthright, which Jacob actually buys from Esau, and then he has to actually steal the blessing. Usually we think of those two things as running together and being together in the same, but frequently they're separated. Judah gets the blessing, and so he is the tribe of kings, he is the tribe of the Messiah, and he's first on our list. And then Reuben coming next, again, would make sense because he is the eldest and would be the next perhaps to be referenced. Who are Gad, Asher, and Naphtali? Dan got chopped. He got knocked off of the list. But Gad, Asher, and Naphtali all have something in common that's interesting. Absolutely. These are the children of the concubines. They're not the children of Rachel and Leah, the actual wives of Jacob. These are Bilhah and Zilpah. Yeah, these are their children who are referenced next. And the suggestion is by elevating them and placing them at this high position on the list, what we're really getting is the Lord again showing us how he has this interesting tendency to make the first last and the last first. I guess from one perspective, commentators suggest that this may be even suggestive of the inclusion of Gentiles, those who are not born initially of the covenant, but in a broad kind of sense. To go forward with the idea, the ceiling, again, I tend to not think of this personally as the Jews of the Old Covenant because of the familiarity of language. If you remember back when he spoke to the church at Philadelphia in Revelation chapter 3 and in verse 12, "He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from heaven, out of heaven from God, and I will write on him my new name." That was a promise that was made to the Christians of that very age, that God would write his name on their forehead and the name of his holy city. And now you see this group of people who are being sealed. And what are they being sealed with? Chapter 14. We have a turn and a reference back to this 144,000. We got to look at just the first few verses of chapter 14. Then I looked and behold a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the voice of many waters and like the voice of loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps, and they sang as it were before as it were a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. These are the ones who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. So the 144,000, and I can't see any possibility, these are two different groups here. Verse 7, chapter 7, verses chapter 14, we get a larger description of them. And again, I think this larger description supports the idea that these are not Jews of the Old Covenant, that these are Christians. These are people who have been sealed by God because they've been redeemed. What have they been redeemed by? The blood of Christ. Again, so were the Jews under the Old Covenant. I recognize that that's by the blood by which all are redeemed, and that doesn't necessarily become exclusive. But you have, to me, language in chapter 14 that really supports the idea that we're dealing with really all the saved. And we're getting two different pictures in chapter 7 and verses 5 through 8 and then verse 9 and 10 of what are essentially, I think, the same group of people who are appearing here. I do want to stop and say this. The class, I think Jeff has chosen to take a proactive approach to the class by teaching what is and not spending time refuting what isn't. But you do have a major religious group that has some very specific views on this chapter. And that particular religious group teaches that what we're seeing here are the 144,000 who are going to be the members of that group, who are going to actually literally be 144,000 people up in heaven in eternity. And the great multitude are those who, well, they were good people, but they weren't members of that group that they needed to be, so they're down, going to be down on earth. If anything, it's exactly backwards to that in the text itself. But there's a great danger when we study the book of Revelation in terms of what we take literally and what we take figuratively. And one of the big mistakes that I think people make in study of Revelation and in commentary is we want to take one thing and make it literal and then kind of take a whole bunch of other stuff figurative instead. Let's say that this is literally to be understood as correct. There are literally going to be 144,000 saved of this religious group who are going to be up in heaven with God. Of what nationality do they have to be? All Jews. They can't be Gentiles because this is the 12 tribes of Israel. If the 144,000 is literal, then why isn't the nationality of the 144,000? What else can we say about them based on chapter 14? They got to be all men. They got to be all virgins. And an even number of them from each of the tribes that are listed here. Is this a text that the Lord expected us to take literally? No. Again, it's a big mistake to grab one thing and make it literal and then try to say, oh, no, the rest of it's not literal, the rest of it's just figurative. That becomes very, very poor commentary, very poor Bible study if we take that sort of approach going through it. What else is placed into this text by the larger religious world, which, again, I don't think is the point or is going on here at all? Anyone? In premillennial theory, this is where we get the rapture. They say that this is the rapture of the faithful saints on earth who are raptured and taken up into heaven at this point. To me, that's the figure. I think you have the faithful of this earth in the first part of it who are going through and dealing with this tribulation. And then what we see in verses 9 and following is this same group of people who are now up in heaven. But notice, they weren't sheltered from any tribulation, were they? These are people who are not going to have to, and let's get down to that verse, hunger anymore, thirst anymore, the sun's not going to strike them anymore, and God's going to dwell among them. So what does that mean about these people? Prior to this glorification in heaven, what did they have to go through? Tribulation. The Great Tribulation in specific. And so the idea that they've been raptured and escaped the Great Tribulation is completely counter to what actually goes on in the text. They've gone through that tribulation. I'm going to throw this out there. When is this Great Tribulation going on? Is this an event that we're yet looking forward to? It's happening right now. Again, we're dealing with a great book of symbols and figures in picture, and we're not, I believe, looking forward to a great tribulation to come. We're not looking forward to a millennium to come. Those are both pictures, different pictures of the reality of being a Christian and life, I think, as we face it right now. We deal with sickness. We deal with hunger and thirst, and all of these things are the realities that we face. Go ahead. And I included this in an early PowerPoint, if you remember. Chapter 5, he hears that the lion of the tribe of Judah has prevailed. When he turns around and looks, what does he see? The lamb that's been slain. We get to the latter chapters of the book, he hears about the bride, the wife of the lamb, and when he turns around to look, what does he see? He sees the great city descending from heaven. That's the pattern of the book. He hears something, but then he turns to look at it, and it's not the same thing. And yet, it is the same thing. It's just being viewed from a different perspective. So I think that's exactly the point. And it follows with the basic pattern of Revelation as we go through. So that's my discussion of that. And again, there's plenty of room for plenty more, but we'll move forward for class. Who are these that are arrayed in white robes, and where did they come from? I'm skipping, I guess, some things that I shouldn't skip. We have, again, the great multitude in verse 9. They are before the throne and before the Lamb, verse 9, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands. What would that bring about in our minds? Similarities, parallel. Yeah, in our minds, we've got to see the triumphal entry there. Palm branches, which had come to represent something fairly significant to the Jews. And here in Revelation, we see the same imagery picked up in the hands of those who are before the throne, who are essentially praising God. Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And all of the angels, once again, we have this scene of glory that appears, this scene of praise that appears. They fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom, thanksgiving and honor, power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen. So this is, I think, a similar scene to what we saw in verse 5 with all creation glorifying God. But these are the redeemed. These are the saved who are in heaven, who are now praising God forever and ever. And that seems to be the sense of what's going on. Then we get to the question. One of the elders answered and saying to me, who are these arrayed in white robes? Where do they come from? I just love that. John's response to this question is, you know, why don't you tell me? And so he gets this answer. These are the ones who have come out of the great tribulation, washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Obviously, there's a great paradox there in terms of color, a paradox there in terms of the way that we think about things being made clean. What is the last thing that you ever want to get on your clothing if you want to get it cleaned and wear it again? Blood. Blood's one of the worst things to have to try to get out, the stains of it to remove. And yet, it is through the washing in the blood of the Lamb that these robes are not made red. It's through the washing of the blood of the Lamb that these robes are actually made white. And there's probably something fairly significant about these robes which they're allowed to wear. Only through the sacrifice of the blood of Christ. That's the only way that we can be redeemed. It's the only way that we can be a part of this scene ultimately, to stand before the throne of God and before the Lamb. That's where they are. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve Him day and night in His temple. And He sits on the throne He who sits on the throne will dwell with them forever. You have a couple of references here that are interesting. There's one that Jeff wanted to point out, I know, in particular, and that's the use of the term dwell here. Does that term ring any bells? John 1. The Word was with God, the Word was God. He becomes flesh, and what does He do? Down around verse 12 or 14, I forget. He dwells among us. The interesting thing is the alternative translation here, tabernacle. And this is quite literally the word that is translated in other places, tabernacle, with a big T. What's the tabernacle doing in this scene? Why would the tabernacle of God appear here? In fact, when you get to the great scene at the very end of the book of Revelation, chapter 21, we're going to have another reference to the tabernacle of God being among His people. What is that about? Yeah. There is, a visual here. That's a great word to use. A visual here of God having fellowship and dwelling among His people. When the children of Israel were moving between Egypt and the land of Canaan, they had a very set plan for movement, and they had a very set plan for camping. Each tribe had its own location where they were supposed to be in association with what? It's the tabernacle. And the tabernacle represented God dwelling among His people, God having fellowship with them. Is that something we enjoy now? In a spiritual sense, yes. There is a sense in which we have fellowship with God. There is a sense in which He dwells among us. We're going to partake, Lord willing, in a little while of the Lord's Supper, which is very much symbolic and emblematic of that dwelling of God among us. And yet we recognize a day to come when we can see this scene in a full and in a real sense as we're in His presence. The 17th verse, "For the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." Again, we have so much imagery that appears here. The Lord is pictured in verse 17 as the shepherd. And again, I hope we can see from the very language that is being used here, that what He is writing about, certainly with this great multitude, we can take different views perhaps of the 144,000, but certainly with this great multitude that appears here, who are we talking about? We're talking about Christians. We're talking about people who choose to make the Lord their shepherd, allow themselves to be led by Him, and to be provided for by Him, fountains of living water, which the Lord promises to pour out. And it is through following the Lamb that we have the fulfillment of the blessing that God will wipe every tear from their eyes. And again, where is this theme picked up again? The book of Revelation is all about foreshadowing. You have elements in the discussion of the seven churches of Asia. Did you notice we came back this morning and talked about one or two of those? As you work your way through the book of Revelation, you keep coming back to things which have been previously referenced in little subtle ways, perhaps, in small ways that give us a sense of the greater fulfillment when we get to them. And where does this text lead us? This is going to lead us, well, Psalm 23 in the Old Testament, but ultimately in the New Testament, Revelation 21. In the first several verses, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from heaven, from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself will be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. And there shall be no more pain, for the former things shall have passed away." What are we getting alluded to here in the end of chapter 7, I think we're getting just a little brief glimpse of the great blessings of heaven that are ultimately talked about in chapters 21 and chapter 22. And to me, that provides perspective on what we're seeing in to me, some of these difficult chapters. Look for the references past, look for the references future in the book of Revelation, and I think they tie us where we are. Are you a part of the great multitude? Are you sealed with the name of God on your forehead? I don't think those are things that are going to happen in the future. I think those are choices that we make right now. We make the choice to submit to Christ, to be his sheep, and to follow him. And then we get just the briefest hint here of the blessings of heaven that are promised for those who become a part of this group of the redeemed. Any comments? That really is interesting. You have the lamb being the one who guides us, being the shepherd. I would say this as well. I don't know that we really need to talk in terms about Jesus being qualified to be our Redeemer, if that necessarily makes sense to use that kind of language and from that perspective talk about things. But we do have a number of references in Hebrews to the experiences of Christ and why they make him our perfect mediator, why they make him our perfect redeemer. Why is it that we can look to Christ as the good shepherd? Is it not because he himself became a sheep for us in order to make it possible for us to become his sheep indeed and to have that hope of heaven? Any other comments? I don't have anything else to add this morning. All right. We will stop at that point, and Lord willing, Jeff will be back with us on Wednesday night.